Today it is our privilege and our joy to join together in the Christian act of confirmation as these young persons renew the promises that were first made for them when they could not speak for themselves at the time of their baptism. We will listen intently and carefully as these five young persons come before us and all the company of heaven to pledge their faith in Jesus Christ and to make their sacred promise to follow him and build their life around him. But as important as all that is, it does not start there. Their promises and all the promises any of us can ever make are secondary to God's promises to us. I will be your God, and you will be my people. You and I are people of the covenant, or people of the promise, not because of the promises we make, but because of God's promise and God's promises to us and to all the world. It's never about what we do to make our way to God, but what God has already done and is now doing to beat a path into our lives and our hearts. Today, what these five young persons are being invited to do is to claim God's promises for themselves and to take their place as part of a community of faith that is striving to embrace and embody God's presence. To claim God's promises is to acknowledge the grace and work of God in our lives and in the life of the world around us. It is also about letting God's Spirit come fully alive in us and to take control of our lives. There was once a picture that I forgot to call attention to, so we'll skip it and come back to it. There was once in an old story that you may have heard already, but if we never re-listen to old stories, think of what life would be like. There was once an old monastery that had fallen on hard times. In its day, people had flocked to it, had found great joy and comfort and peace in its beautiful singing, its worship, its prayer, its quiet. But no more. Fewer and fewer people visited the monastery. One by one, the younger monks left in frustration and dissatisfaction, and all that remained was a group of older and disgruntled monks waiting to die, spending all of their days bickering and blaming each other for the monastery's decline. The abbot, their leader, did not know what to do. As it happened, the abbot had an old friend, a rabbi, who lived nearby in the woods. In despair, the abbot went to visit the rabbi, to pour out his heart and his troubles, lamenting the sad state of affairs in the monastery, hoping against hope that the rabbi might offer a solution. The rabbi listened patiently, and then sat in silence, pondering the abbot's plea for advice. At last, the rabbi spoke. "I, too, do not know what to do," the rabbi said. "But I do know this. The Messiah is among you." "The Messiah among us? How can that be?" sputtered the abbot. "Who is it?" "That I cannot say," replied the rabbi. "But if you return to your monks and tell them what I've told you in due time, the answer will be revealed and will be clear." The abbot raced back through the woods and summoned all the monks to report what he'd been told. "The Messiah here among us," they exclaimed. How can that be? Surely it is not Brother Samuel. He's always grumbling to himself. And when he's not muttering, it's because he's rude and obnoxious. But then, when any one of us is sick, isn't Samuel the one to first come and attend to us? It's definitely not Brother Albert. He's always forgetting his chores and leaving them for us to do instead, but you know, he does set a fine table with fresh flowers to beautify our lives. It's absolutely not Brother Leo. He's always so dirty and smells bad too. But I suppose that's because he works so hard in the vegetable garden for our meals. Brother Thomas? Brother Thomas? Impossible. He's constantly dumping ink all over the desk where we copy the scriptures out by hand. Of course, though, his lettering and drawings are nearly perfect. The best we've ever seen. One by one, they went over each other's faults as well as each other's redeeming qualities. And just in case, they began treating each other with new and greater respect and kindness. And as time passed, the outside world took note of the change. They began returning to the monastery, for they found in it a new spirit, a new sense of joy and compassion, new life-giving energy that could heal their broken hearts, their tattered relationships, their weary lives. It is, in fact, that spirit that matters most in life. And that spirit that you and I and these young persons come here seeking. In fact, if I could gather all of the United Methodists across the city of Syracuse together, I would tell them to throw away all of their planning parties, which are not parties at all. I would tell them to quit meeting and struggling and disagreeing. Oh, Tom, there are disagreements, are there not? Tom and I have been party to some of those disagreements. I would tell them this simple story and call them to be mindful of the spirit that is at the center of everything we are and everything we do. Allison, Ben, oh, look at their heads come up. Ben, Diamond, Jonathan, Geraldine, let me say to you now that as you go through life, you can make all the money in the world. You can claim all the best friends in the world. You can dress in the finest clothes that you can get your hands on. You can learn everything there is to know. You can become bishop or even pope. And you can give everything away to support this church and persons in need. But if the spirit is missing, if the spirit is absent, you are nothing. You accomplish nothing. You have nothing. So how and where do we find that spirit? Often it's as mystifying as a hunt for Waldo. And we flail. Oh, Elise says she found him. And we go in lots of directions. But for the past two Sundays, you have been receiving in your bulletin a little handout inviting you to name the life-giving, the energizing, the filling activities that you would want this church to offer to yourselves and to others. And we have received a number of those forms back. If you have not turned your form in yet, please do so today so that we can begin to address the suggestions you have made for us. But on the back side is new information. Information that suggests there is not simply one way, one path to God, but in fact many different kinds of paths. I'm going to invite you to do two things. One is to listen to a brief description of what's on that wheel. Four kinds of spiritualities listed in this diagnostic tool. To the top half, those would be numbers 1 and 4. Those are for persons who tend to be more head type, who like to think about God and think our way to God. The bottom half, numbers 2 and 3, would be persons who are more oriented around our feelings, our experience, our inward knowing of God. Now, if you go to the right side of the screen, numbers 1 and 2, it is for persons who like to focus on the specifics, the concrete, the real experiences. And at the other pole, items 3 and 4, persons who are more abstract and like to look at things globally. If you've ever done the Myers-Briggs, you know some of those differentiations. They parallel those. I'll be honest with you. When it comes to concrete data in the Myers-Briggs, I have a perfect score. I have never scored anything above a 0. Everything is global as I look at it. But that's my way. That's not your way. So I'm going to invite you to take the form home with you and to answer the questions that are posed there. And when you are done, simply take count of how many number 1s you have filled in, how many number 2s you have filled in, how many number 3s you have filled in, how many number 4s you have filled in, and you'll begin to get a sense of the kind of spirituality, 1, 2, 3, or 4, that best serve you and your spirit as it seeks to meet God's spirit. We'll say some more about that perhaps in a newsletter article, but I want to leave that there with you and come back to our sense of who we are today and what God's spirit calls us to be about. John the Baptist said to those who had come out to witness what he was doing in the wilderness, he said to them, "Among you stands one whom you do not recognize, whom you do not see, whom you do not know." I invite you to cast a quick glance around this sanctuary. Is there one that you do not recognize? Could in fact, like that ancient monastery, could in fact the Messiah be seated here among us? Could the Messiah be found among our confirmation class members, in our choir, in our handbell choir, in the persons who served breakfast this morning, in the persons who prepare for our worship on Sunday morning, in the persons who carry out the work of this congregation Monday through Friday? Look around you. I'm serious. Look around you. Might the Messiah be seated among you? you remember the story of John the Baptist, it does not end well. But to be filled with God's Spirit does not mean we get everything we want. It does mean that when we see the world around us hurting and in despair, we are willing to be voices of that which brings life and healing and hope and reconciliation to all persons, not just to ourselves. We are willing to believe that in the midst of that which is unjust and destructive of life and community, Jesus is there, suffering and weeping. And as we continue towards Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, it is never enough to focus on Jesus being born somewhere. It is always about Jesus being born in us and letting God's Spirit fill us, use us, claim us, and in a moment, we will watch eagerly and listen carefully as these special five young persons begin to make that declaration for themselves. Amen.